The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another live edition of The Heretics Hour on this Monday, July 23rd, 2012. It's going to be another excellent program tonight, and timely, as the subject, How to Build a White Nation, is one that several white nationalists have been writing about recently. And on my Saturday program just 2 days ago, I had Alex Linder on speaking about what direction the white nationalist movement should take. So to carry on with this theme, so to speak, although it wasn't exactly planned this way, it just happened, tonight I'm pleased to have with me someone who's become a Heretics Hour favorite, this being his fourth visit to the show, and that is Severus Niffelsen, whose blog is Niffelsen's Mind at niffelsen.blogspot.com. That's spelled N-I-F-L-S-O-N. Hello, Severus.
Hello, how are you? Thank you for having me once again. Appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you being willing to come on. The last time you were on the Heretics Hour was just a little over 1 month ago, on June 18th, and you were discussing your latest blog post, and which was about asking, were white nationalist males too weak, becoming weak, and suffering from weakness, and that became quite controversial. We had a lot of discussion of different viewpoints on the comments at the White Network. And it was a very popular program and had lots of listeners, lots of downloads. It moved right up to one of the, you know, top spots in my program. So now tonight, you've written another article. You don't write often. When you do, you've really thought it out. And so I like what you write so much. So Your newest article that's on your blog is The Prefab Republic, and I was so happy that you were addressing these questions. And I want to say that when I read everything I've read by you, I always feel an authenticity, and when I talk to you too, a genuineness to your writing and your talking, and it comes through to me that you really do put your race first, and that's what you're working for. So I really mean it. And you go ahead and introduce us to your thoughts for tonight.
Well, once again, I appreciate you having me. And yes, a lot of these things tend to be what I call synchronicity, right? What Jung used to call synchronicity. We tend to usually end up discussing the same type of subjects in different ways at the same time, and it's not coordinated, but it ends up seeming to be right. We all have been talking about this, and of course, I'm part of it. So I, for some reason, I actually started writing an article about something else, and then, you know, something struck me. I wanted to actually talk about this Republic thing, and the basic gist of the article is, as you can tell from the title, is that a lot of white nationalists, what we're doing lately is basically prefab. We're creating a prefab concept of a republic. We're basically trying to skip the actual work of doing it, and we're going to the fun part of actually creating a republic or a nation, which is basically put a name to it, put a flag on it, you know, create an anthem, you know, the cool stuff, the stuff that it's very attractive, that most of us can participate on, right? It's very egalitarian, because these are the things that all of us can do. Any person in his basement can sit around and create a nation. This is not a very sophisticated thing, because, and this, at the stage that we're discussing, we're talking about, we're just coming up with ideas and putting them together. And I didn't necessarily mention, like I spoke with you privately, I didn't really mention groups in particular, because almost every single aspect of what I'm discussing in the article applies to almost every group. And there's a lot of them. There's not really only one, two. I would say there's about four in the United States that basically promote the same thing. And they basically do the same thing. They give you everything done. And then your job is really to be a consumer. You basically have to choose the republic that you would like to live in. and choose the symbols that you like. Oh, you know what? I like this flag. I kind of like where they're at. You know, I kind of like the symbols. I'm kind of digging the Constitution. You know, like you're basically a consumer. You're buying something, basically. And it's very American in that sense. It's a very American idea to basically create these things and then kind of sell them as products, right? And whoever has the nicest website, the nicest product placement, the nicest references, the one that upsets the least people, because you know how sensitive white nationalists are, right? So if you offend the least amount of us, suddenly this becomes a popular idea. That's kind of like, that's the basic idea of the article.
Yeah, and you know, it's true how much people, especially men, I guess, love designing flags. I mean, I ran into that early on, and people, I had was in a group, and people, they all they wanted to do was talk about how the kind of flag designs, and also the uniforms that they were designing uniforms. Yeah, you know, all that cool stuff, like you say, you know, but actually, how are you going to do it when it's, you know, I don't really want to go into any more detail on that, but.
I mean, I think it's actually one of the first things I mentioned in the article, if we're going to dive really into it. One of the first things that I actually talk about is the fact that I think this whole concept of the White Republic is a very American concept, and I think it has American characteristics, right? Because it is, in reality, a product of the American way of seeing the world. Because for a European, for example, and I mentioned that in the article, the White Republic is their nation. That's the White Republic. And so it's a Frenchman, even though France is being overrun, they still expect that the France is going to be the white nation. You know what I mean? And to the Spaniard, it's going to be Spain. And because the connection and the psychological attachment to these nations, right, and to these historic regions is an actual real one, right? It's a very permanent psychological one, and there's also a very deep ethnic connection to these areas. Whereas Americans are uprooted, right? They don't feel that, even whites, right? Because white Americans are basically a hodgepodge of European ethnicities. So they don't really have an ethnic connection per se, right? There's a joke that I always mention because I always find it funny, but I've heard this, and people say that you know, I'm a third Irish, a third German, a third Polish, a third Russian, a third Italian.
You know, you're so right about that. And it is true that Europeans do not think about this the way we do here in the United States.
Yeah, because the most of them have a singular ethnic affiliation.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. That's, you know, it's a totally different experience for them. And, you know, Tan Stoffel and I were talking before we started this network, and you know, we agreed on this, that that we needed to put our attention and think of ourselves as white Americans and not try to get too involved with Europe and Europeans, even though I can't keep from doing that, but because it's different, you know, and we have a very different situation here, and we have to figure out how we should be handling it and what to do with it. We can't follow what they're doing, because among Germans, they're very, very attached to Germanness, and it's all about, you know, the German nation and the German Volk and all that. So it's
a completely different world, and it's mm-hmm. to an American white person, it's easier to come up with and envision these kind of unified, kind of almost like white nationalist egalitarian states, because to them, it's not an issue of being German, or the idea of unity to them is easier, because to an American, it's already in them. They are part of that unity, right? Genetically, ethnically, they are that unity. But to a European, it sounds like an alien concept, because to them, I don't know, they're just thinking, what the hell are these people thinking about? I mean, I don't know, I cannot relate to this, right? Mm-hmm. So the reason I make that point is because I think it is a reflection of American culture. The issue is whether or not a white nationalist in the United States that are playing with this republic concept are not falling too much into the modern Americanism, which is this consumer culture, fast food nonsense that we've all been corrupted with all over the world. And I think my argument is that we are kind of falling into that by doing too much of things that we shouldn't be doing when we're trying to even think about how republics should be done. Like, for example, territorial proposals, right? Kind of like you take a map and you say, okay, so my white nation is going to be here. And you take a magic marker and you mark it. And we're talking about like four guys in a living room talking about where their state is going to be. I mean, that's pretty crazy if you think about it, because one thing is to have an idea. You can have, like, you know what, I would like a piece of the United States to be white, and I think that's going to happen. But it is kind of nuts to actually make determinations of territory when all territories historically have been determined by wars, skirmishes, you know, war, you know, death, treaties, etc. I mean, there's so many actual organic ways in which territories are defined. They're not defined in a living room by two guys per se, right? So that's the criticism. The criticism is that we are overdoing things that are irrelevant, because at the end of the day, when we're at that moment, which we may not see, we may see it, when we're at that moment, that territory is not going to be defined that way. We could end up like with one town, or we could end up with four states. I mean, this is the type of thing that you can't really determine and make a determination in a living room. And I think that's a problem. I think that seeing that way, it's too American.
Is it kind of fantasy? I mean, are we indulging too much in fantasy? Yeah. We don't get into real world. And probably internet, the power of the internet probably helps that along some.
Yes, of course, because when I was younger, when I came to the United States when I was 17 years old, I remember that no white nationalist was talking about state proposals except Butler, right? But what these guys were talking about was an actual real, like, they had a compound, right, where guys with guns, like, they had an actual physical place, and mm-hmm. they envisioned a region, but they envisioned it in a more organic way, almost like the Mormons, right? Let's all move here to this town, and then we'll take it over, that type of thing. But those are organic methods of acquiring territory. But the internet has allowed anyone to just make a website and call it the white magician Nazi republic, and then make a cool flag, and then just say, you know what, we're going to live in Alaska, and then just say, declare Alaska a new republic. And I could just indulge my fantasies of nation building. And I actually mock this, but I'm doing it in a kind way. I'm not necessarily saying that every person does this. I mean, all of us have at some point engaged in fantasy, especially males, because males have these type of fantasies are natural. I think they're healthy. We imagine ourselves like founding fathers, right? They're going to build a statue of me and the plaza. You know? I'm on top of a horse or the guns or whatever. But the reality is completely different than this. And my point of the article is that we're not really ready for this. We should be focusing on things that we actually require right now, and not necessarily fantasize too much, because I think we just stay in fantasy. And this is the reason a lot of times people in forums, they'll spend, you know, their days, years arguing with each other about fantastical things, right? About, no, my state will have the right to bear arms. And another guy, no, it should not have the right to bear arms.
Yeah.
And it's crazy, because instead of doing something that's actually practically effective, they're just wasting their time.
Well, that's right. This is what so many are doing now. They want to persuade people, as you're saying, like in the consumerism, they want to persuade people that the way that their idea is the right idea, and the other people's, and I get involved in that too. This too, you know. What else are we doing? We're just talking. So, I like it this way, and this won't work, and that won't, and we're just talking. And there's some value in this, but it's not really accomplishing anything. And the points that you make in this article, I think, are real important.
Well, that's one of the disclaimers I wanted to make, and we can't be delusional either, right? In other words, theoretical discussions, but they cannot replace practical organic realities, right? So the point is that when you speak about theoretical things, you have to have some level of transparency, and you have to admit, yes, this is theoretical, and then you discuss the theory, right? But then you have to, the actual work is to transition, right, from theory to reality. And that is actually the work, right? But the theories are important. I agree. In other words, it's okay to discuss, hey, wouldn't it be great to have a republic? Wouldn't it be nice for it to be this way, that way? That's fine. The problem is that we overstep it. In other words, we go beyond it. One thing is to argue about the things that we like, the things that, we think are great, but there comes a point in which you have to actually analyze the things that are not glamorous. I mentioned in the article that everyone talks about the military, and they always talk about, yes, I would like to be a general and run tanks. You know, all the fancy stuff in war, like tanks and artillery, whatever. But they don't think about logistics, which is actually the most important thing, right? You know, how to get food to the troops. You know, the stuff that is not glamorous is not in Hollywood. In other words, I think our movement is infected a little bit with a little bit of a Hollywood fantasy of how things kind of work. And a lot of it is this type of thing. So the theoretical work goes, the theoretical discussion goes from actual practical things. What do we do now? What should we do? How do we talk to these people? How do we get more people? And it becomes more of, look, I'm going to have a libertarian white nationalist republic, and if you don't like it, you'll get executed. That's the thing. You know what I mean? Like, crazy stuff that doesn't make any sense and doesn't help us at all. So, I mean, that's really my criticism. But again, this is all theory. Now, I admit that what we're discussing is all theoretical. But I do think that it's healthy for us to admit when something is theoretical. I was joking that when I made my article, people are going to notice this when they go, I somewhat tongue-in-cheek make the case that I'm going to indulge in this. Like, trying to make the point that it's not that bad, but we have to stop ourselves. In other words, we can stop at making the flag. Let's just make the flag and then stop it, right? So I myself say, look, I found this flag and it looks kind of cool. And I invented this term, so let's put it in there. So that's kind of nice, but let's stop, right? But I actually got a lot of people saying, what an awesome flag. That's the flag, you know. And that's kind of my point. Yes, that's we can suggest flags, but that's not enough. That's not building a nation. So I actually go in the article to basically discuss my ideas of the type of things that we should be thinking about that I think are practical, always acknowledging that we're still in the theoretical world. That's why I don't get angry. In other words, if a guy calls me and tells me, look, you're wrong, we have to build a fascist state, that type of thing, I'm going to indulge it because it's a theory. The guy's not really making a fascist state with guys with uniforms. He's just talking to me, saying the things that he likes. We can engage people like this, but we have to acknowledge that we're still talking about fantasy, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. So we should let people talk, I guess. I mean, we shouldn't get so serious when it's just talk. And we shouldn't get angry, and we shouldn't try to stomp out the the other person's ideas or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's all still in the idea stage. But then how? Where do we go from there? Where do we go from here?
Well, that's the thing. The thing is that, for example, if I call a guy that's building his own republic and he already has a constitution, because these things to me are amazing to me. I mean, there's a lot of these groups that have constitution, things that are supposed to be done as a group. I mean, it's actually somewhat insulting to white people because we're basically redesigning everything to them, and we're just telling them, you're going to accept this anthem even if you hate it, that type of thing. So we are basically creating, we're doing all the hard work. Instead of actually getting together in a constitutional assembly, right, and making a constitution, no, I'm actually giving you everything pre-done. But the problem is, if I address this, they'll get angry at me. They'll insult me, they'll say, whatever. They'll just say that I'm being I'm destroying the movement, I really want something bad, I have evil intentions, whatever. Because they don't see it as theory. They don't see it as a concept. They actually see it as a reality. And that's what I'm actually criticizing. What I'm saying is, it's okay if you admit that this is a theory. The problem is when you take it too seriously, because that means that you're not going to do any work. You already did the work. In other words, you already founded the nation. You are a founding father. You deserve to have a statue done of you, and that's it. And you'll just lay back and wait, you know, wait for it to happen. And that's the problem. What I think, and this is maybe the controversial aspect of what I wrote, is the idea that we actually require qualified people to build any nation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, here we come to the, what we actually need besides flag designers and people who are setting out what they think it should be.
Exactly. What actually requires...
I like where you said the designers. Where was that? I guess I haven't come to that part yet. But, you know, yeah, here. But once we cross the line into the actual prefabrication of a country by a few activists, and then you put in parentheses designers, without having any real-world justification for it, then we have surrendered ourselves to the influence of market capitalism and consumer culture. Exactly. That, you know, people, you see, I like that term, saying, well, these are people, you know, we're designing something, but we're not really, you know, it's
we're just acting as designers, which is funny about the uniforms. When you said the uniform thing, I always find it funny because it's all somewhat feminine if you think about it, because we're basically like designing, you know, we're like designing a party, right? It's kind of gay, you know, like let's make uniforms and let's make flags and cool symbols, but we're not talking about like the nitty gritty of it. And the nitty gritty of it is, what do we need to have a functional system? Like let's forget about the state and let's call it a club, a company, whatever you want to call it. When you're going to build a company, a club or whatever, you actually require qualified individuals to run this thing. You can't just have a guy design a cool logo for the company and a name. Oh, I'm going to call it this name. I'm going to, this is the logo. That's it. You know, register and you're good to go. No, then you need, what the hell, you know, you need more. You need to, what the hell are you going to sell? What is it? Who's going to do this? Who's going to do management? Who's, you know, you require actual staffing. And the problem that we have in the white nationalist movement is that we don't have a staff. We just have a bunch of designers. Everyone's designing stuff. But where's the staff? See, the staff is actually regular white people, the people that we actually need. And one of the things I actually address is that a lot of white nationalists shun the people that we actually need. Because, and it's legitimate. In other words, there's a legitimate distrust for people that actually have functional lives in a way. Because we acknowledge the system is corrupt and the system is evil, right? Most white nationalists, I presume, agree with the statement, right? So because the system we live in is corrupt, and those who function effectively within it must be corrupt themselves. And it seems to be like the logical conclusion. If these people function within it, that they have to be part of it. I disagree with this. I actually think that you can have functioning people, people that are good at being functional and at the same time hold our views and be consistent, as long as these people are not basically slaves of the system. In other words, as long as these people are not dishonest. But it does take a bit of cleverness to be able to do a couple of things at the same time. And to build a nation and build a company, you can't just have designers. You need engineers. You need doctors. You need everything. You need developers. You need developers in the capital sense. You need people that actually know how to construct things, you know, people that know how to build things, et cetera. And if we don't have these things, we will never have a white republic, period, because you cannot build a white republic with a couple of guys. Even if you have 100,000 designers, it'll be a republic will never last, right? Because you can't have a republic that only functions in designing, unless we're like the first marketing republic that all we do is design stuff for other people. But if we want actually functional, we need fishermen. You know what I mean? We need truckers. We need people that actually do things. And therefore, that should be our objective.
Well, some people would say, well, if you have these leaders who are able to somehow take power and you have a plan that you can put into effect, then all these people will just fall in place because they'll be there and they won't have anywhere else to go. So, you know, all the doctors, the lawyers, the architects, the economists, scientists, and so on, truck drivers and so on, will all just keep doing what they're doing. What would you say to that?
Well, that's an interesting argument. That's a leftist argument. I actually don't disagree with it. It's a vanguardist argument. Let me rephrase it, because I know a lot of people are going to say, oh, I'm accusing them of being Leninist. No, it's a vanguardist. I actually agree with the vanguardist idea. The problem with that, you cannot have a vanguard of designers. You can't have a vanguard of skinheads. I'm saying you cannot have a vanguard of a single group of people. For you to have a true vanguard, you would actually require a diversity of professionals, professionals, I mean, in the context of the professions that they partake in, all right? You require a diversity in that vanguard of people that know how to do these things. In other words, even Lenin himself, he had a bunch of Jewish manipulators and Jewish thieves, right? But he had, like, He had like a construction Jewish thief, right? Then he would have like a medical thief. You know what I'm saying? In other words, he had branches of these areas controlled. Why? Because the most likely scenario is that we're going to acquire power through not some kind of Star Wars type taking over of the government, right? In which you have this guy who's very nice and suddenly he becomes like a Sith Lord in the end and he's like the master, he takes over and people got to obey him. The world doesn't work that way. It's going to probably function in a collapsed type of situation in which there's the police power is broken and then you're going to have these people trying to find those that have leadership to actually put something into place. And people want people, right? Leaders that know what the hell they're doing. And you will not put your trust on a person who doesn't know anything except design flags and design cool websites. Because he doesn't know what the hell he's doing. This is not enough for leadership. For leadership, you actually require people that know what they're doing. And you can look at this in history. People always will look forward to the leadership who is the strongest and who has a crew of people that know what they're doing. That you can trust, you know what, these guys know what they're doing because that guy does management, that guy knows how to run the trains, that type of thing. You know what I mean? You require some knowledge. You cannot expect that we're going to have a vanguard of like 10 guys who are going to take over the world by designing websites and creating cool symbols and having good rhetorical skills. It requires more, is my point. And what I'm saying is that in a type of vacuum, you want to be the guy that knows what he's doing and he happens to be a white nationalist.
Do you see anybody doing that? I mean, do you see anything working toward that where you'd have, you know, a larger amount of competent, capable people who can be
That's actually my criticism. My criticism is that, and that's actually the whole point of me writing that. The whole point of me writing is suggesting that instead of being, and I've encountered this a lot, instead of being so closed off, particularly to the type of people that we actually need, that we should actually be a little bit more strategic about it. And I actually make the case, I don't know if you remember at the end, I basically make the case that if, for example, you're a young white nationalist, you're 18, 20 years old, and you want to make a profession for yourself, you want to do something that will work, instead of dedicating yourself to make flags and dedicating yourself to make websites.
But don't pick on the people who want to make flags. But let's just say dedicating yourself to just thinking politically, you know, just being a political animal, you need to learn something more functional. Isn't that what, that's what you were saying?
I'm using the flag thing as a simple, it's an easy target because I put a flag, everyone puts a flag. What I'm saying is that's not enough. You actually have to find something functional, something that actually would work in a republic and do it. And don't listen to those that tell you that that these things don't matter because you're going to be a slave of the system. Because all of the people that talk like that are usually idiots. Because all you have to do is look at your enemies. Jews don't think that way. Jews don't care like that. They don't see the world that fashion. They want a cousin who does everything. They want another cousin who runs this. They want another cousin who runs that. Because they realize that true power requires a diversity of functions and a diversity of power structures. It's not enough to just be a guy that runs shops. You have to have a doctor, a lawyer, a shop guy, an engineer, an architect. You have to have people everywhere that are part of your collective and they're working towards something, right? Towards a goal. And that goal can be achieved if you have a multiplicity of skills and multiplicity of people that know different things. So my point is, yes, you can do something. You can actually dedicate yourself to find something actually practical and functional that you can actually do that will help the future of white nationalism. And that's basically my point. If you want to build a republic, fine. What the hell you do? Do you know any engineering? Do you know how to trains run? Do you know what I mean? You have to know these things if you're going to have a functional nation. They're not going to trust us with power because we don't deserve power if we don't even know how to run it. That's my point.
Yes. Severus, what kind of a mic are you using or you're not even, your voice is kind of comes and goes. And I don't know, that's the way I hear it. I don't know why that's, I've never heard it that way when I was talking with you.
I don't know. I'll keep it like this. It's a headset, but I'll keep it, you know, like I'll hold the mic because it's one of those mics that dangles. So I'll just hold on to it.
Oh, your mic maybe is moving around.
That's probably.
Well, I don't know, but when you start out, it kind of goes quiet, and then it comes, your voice comes through, and then sometimes it goes way, the volume goes way down again.
Yeah, excuse me. I'll hold the microphone. Don't worry.
Okay, sorry. We'll see how that works. Well, this is why, you know, I think it's so damaging when we hear this negativity that some people, who I really think are disinfo agents, go on about trying to make everybody feel hopeless. Everything, everybody's a liar. Nothing is any good. Nobody's any good. And they really mean white people, you know, anybody who's just doing anything almost. They're all sold out and so on. So that people just get, young people maybe just think, what's the point? And they're just nihilists, and they don't learn things, and they don't learn how to contribute to a real society. And this would put us in a bad position for ever taking any kind of power if the opportunity comes up. And that's another thing. I mean, you have to be ready for the opportunity. You're working to try to create an opportunity, but you don't know how or when it's going to come. And if it comes, you have to be prepared. And you've talked about that in this article.
Yeah, of course. That's the other issue. The one of the problem with people that act this way is that we are creating a bubble, and it's a very dark, kind of gloomy type of bubble in which you have people that come in into the movement. They're interested in our ideas. They come in, and because we have been marginalized, and this has happened on purpose. In other words, our enemies specifically, purposefully marginalize us, because the point of this is to basically create like almost like a little nation of misfits. And they're basically warning those that are a little bit more functional, look, don't even approach those guys because they're dysfunctional freaks. And if you kind of even get near, I'll just push you into it and you'll be there forever type of thing. And unfortunately, people within our movement do this themselves. You know, we usually prolong this experience because we ourselves become more distrustful and more isolated. And we're always fighting with each other, almost like in a small family. Like we have like 20 living in a one bedroom apartment. We're always fighting with each other. We're still in the same house, but we're fighting with each other. And then anybody who sees that from outside thinks we're crazy. They don't want to join us, right? Mm-hmm. I think that to be functional, we have to accept functionality, and we have to be a little bit more flexible. In other words, we can't take certain of our pet theories too seriously. And this is the reason I can get along. I personally try to practice this. In other words, I try to get along with all botanists, CIs, national socialists, because at the end of the day, these are all just, we're still in the theoretical world. So I'm not going to take it personal if they disagree with me or I disagree with them. I hope they don't take it personal, because we're still in the theoretical. I mean, this is not happening yet. You know what I mean? So. I think if we left it open this way, we would attract people that agree with us and may disagree with us in certain things, but we're not going to bash their heads in, call them Jews, whatever the stuff that happens in the white nationalist movements. That is, there's no point to it, because it's not going to change my sleep whether or not some guy disagrees with me about a pet theory of mine or not. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's just, if you're just agreeing with things that don't matter too much, but sometimes it seems like it matters. A lot, and maybe there's just nothing else to do but talk and argue. So if there's anything more important happening, we could be involved with that. Maybe we wouldn't talk and argue so much. We'd come together more.
You're absolutely right. That's the reason. The reason is because we don't have anything else. It's almost like we don't have a date, so we're just going to fight with our family.
So that's funny.
So, of course, we're going to shout at our children because, you know, we don't have a date. But the point is that we have to kind of control this tendency a bit. For example, this tendency of every time someone disagrees with you, then he's suspect. Look, there is a lot of people that are suspect. This is a fact. There is a lot of suspect people in the world. I'm not even talking about movement, just talking in general. If what we're talking about are basic issues, I try not to get into it unless they prove to me that they're actually like a CIA agent or a Jewish agent, these type of accusations. I try to not get into that, because a lot of times when people disagree legitimately, And again, we're in a theoretical realm. We're not in real world. Once we're in real world, we wouldn't just call them something. We would probably put them in prison. You know what I mean? So in the real world, the consequences of actions are actual consequences. They have real meaning in the real world. And you would actually think what you're saying, right? In other words, in internet, people insult each other, they disrespect each other because there's no real consequence to it. In person, you would probably control yourself and not be that disrespectful. This is the same thing. We're suffering a little bit of this kind of situation in which we're just talking to each other constantly. But I do believe we have to be functional. We have to be open to functional people. And we have to be diversify our abilities and diversify the people in our movement with different skills. So when the vacuum hits, when there is an actual situation of emergency, we can be trusted to handle a country because we have the people that know how to handle a country. Hitler knew this, and I mentioned that in my article, because he did have functional people in his party. He didn't just have like hooligans in his party, right? He had, you know, doctors, lawyers, engineers, mechanics. He had everything in the leadership. He had a lot of different people that had different skills that he was able to transplant into the state and make the state function. And the German people could look at them and say, look, these guys know what they're doing. Right? This guy does this. This guy's an engineer. This guy's a doctor. So they trusted him with power because he proved to them that he had the people needed to manage this power.
Right. He put a lot of attention on that. He was doing that all the while he was trying to build up the popularity of the party and get votes into the get people into the Bundestag and stuff. Well, it wasn't called that then. He was working on his team, you know. And of course, economists were a big part of his team too, and which you didn't mention. But so all of this. So what, you know, what would we say that young white nationalists should. They'd have to do it individually because there's nobody ordering them or there's nobody in charge right now. There's not even a William Pierce type person who you know, has a kind of authority that a lot of people will look to and accept. And there's certainly no Adolf Hitler. So there's, individuals would have to discipline themselves and say, well, I'm going to learn something that's going to help this, this white nation. When we get a chance to put it into effect, you know, they have to have that belief in it. They have to have discipline. They have to do this on their own, so to speak, and make themselves capable of something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is what we're doing now by the article, by the show, the way we're communicating. That my objective is to hopefully, if someone cares, get inspired to actually continue saying that. In other words, that we create a subject that's discussed and eventually becomes a common thing, that instead of telling a young 18, 19-year-old, what, you're in the university? This is a Jewish madrasa, whatever, right? We say, you know what? If you're committed to white nationalism, pick something that you think could work that's functional. Do it. Do it effectively. You know, play at their game and stay loyal to the movement. And when things, when we need you, you'll be there. I'd rather have those guys, right, those kind of silent cell type of characters, than have a bunch of guys, you know, marching in the streets while you have like 30 lunatic anti-fascists throwing stuff at them. Because I do think that we need these type of functioning type people in our movement. So my suggestion would be, if you're a white nationalist, then pick something that you actually like, that you think it's, most people have different tastes, right? So it's not, you know, pick something and just do it and become, get an education profession. And of course, if you're a white nationalist already, like for example, I went to university and I was always a white racialist since I was very young. I was not corrupted, manipulated, you know, I didn't become a zombie of the state, right? Just because I went through this process. I went through this process knowing. I went through the process consciously, right? I was not high on LSD or whatever, right? I was not being drugged by the government. I actually had a good experience because I was conscious that I was doing something for a purpose. And if I can do certain things and be functional and at the same time sustain and respect my views, I can in the future be of some help for the movement and be some help for my own people that way, instead of just staying, hanging out with a bunch of guys drinking beers, right, whatever, and screaming about how the government sucks and destroyed, etc. You know what I mean? Like, there comes a point to make a decision. That decision should be practicality sometimes.
But they don't have to, it doesn't even have to be university. It doesn't hurt to go to university, but you should have a good trade. You should have a good knowledge of something. And you can teach you can learn a lot without going to university. I've been guilty of saying, oh, nobody needs to go to college anymore because it's just, you just get propagandized. But then again, like you point out about yourself, if you're not unaware like so many are, but if you're aware and you know what you're after, kind of like after World War II, when the GI Bill, these GIs were pretty good university students because they were older, they knew what they had been through a lot, and they knew why they were going to school. They knew why they wanted to get an education, what they were going to use it for. They weren't just young people being influenced by the party environment or whatever around them. So, this is the kind of attitude we have to have, this more mature attitude and with a purpose, saying, to think long term. Exactly. And to have some faith.
that's remember I told you the story about the experiment that they give a black child that tell him, look, you can have a candy now or three in a week. And the black children always go for, just give me the candy now. And white children tend to say, okay, I'll just hold off on the immediate gratification, just get the three candies, the three pieces. But white nationals are like the black kids, they just want instant gratification. What I'm saying is we shouldn't think of instant gratification. Look, the people that are lost, the people that shouldn't go to college are not white nationals. Because the people who go to college right now, they would go anyway, wouldn't listen to us because they don't agree with us. Are the ones that are being manipulated, are the ones that are being brainwashed. Do you understand what I mean? A person who's already in our camp, and he gets brainwashed, he was never in our camp. Because a person who really knows. I'm talking to those guys. See, a person who already knows, what I'm telling him is basically, look, you need to partake of the, you have to use the structure against the structure. You have to use the system against the system. And instead of being like, this is something that you probably, the left, right, the communists, they know this. They put this into practice. In the 60s and 70s, these guys were, screw the system, down with the man, all that. And now they're like in Harvard running things, right? Now, why did they do that? Because it was a movement at the time that was very practical. It was run by Jews. It was very practical. They said, no. You want to destroy a system, you destroy it from within. So go into those systems, take their degrees, use their degrees against them, right? I'm somewhat arguing the same in a different way. All I'm saying is, yes, I agree. You don't have to go to university. I use university as an extreme example because the university is the most, the hated institution, legitimately so, within our movement. So I'm using it as an extreme example. If you hate it, but you think you can use the whatever they give you to learn actual practical knowledge, and you can use that knowledge, or you can use that degree for something for white nationalism when it's really needed, then you should do it. You should see it as a warrior. You should think as a strategy. You should be strategic. If we don't have enough strategic people in our movement, we're doomed. We have to be strategic. So that's all I'm saying. Yes, you can be. You don't have to. You could educate yourself at home, but there's certain professions that you can't educate yourself at home. You're going to have to bite the bullet, be an adult, and actually. We can't act like children all the time. We have to actually be an adult and say, you know what? I hate these guys. I hate what the system. But you know what? I'm going to go in, incognito. I get it done.
Yeah, that's the real warrior spirit. You're right. And don't you think that it's good, it would help to have a kind of collective spirit to understand the value of collective action, our collective togetherness or so on, that not so much, if we focus on the individual satisfaction, you're not going to accomplish what you need to accomplish for the collective. And we have to have that collective spirit, I think, to have any kind of to accomplish a white nation, which is a huge, huge task. It certainly isn't easy.
Exactly. It's not like you're building a lemonade stand. It's actually building something huge. We're talking about an entire system. You know how difficult this is? That's why no one can build it on their own. That's why that has never happened. That's why people have to organically work on it, because you require so many people with skills that you do not possess. You require a collective effort, because only collectively you can achieve things of that magnitude. And you're absolutely right. The reason that white nationalists see the world that way is because they're individualists. This is a very American thing as well, because mm-hmm. see the world as an individual, right? It's a very individualistic, very like libertarians, but they see the world about their own gratification. So they don't think long-term because they're thinking of themselves. As an example, the guy that tells you, no, I'm not going to do this because it goes against my principles, as an example. But I've heard this said from communists. You know, I've met communists and Trotskyists that tell me this. My principles tell me that I'm not going to take a loan. That's because I'm participating in the system. I understand their argument. But my point is that sometimes this is not because of true principles. Sometimes out of ego. In other words, it's about ego gratification. They want to have a good bad badge. They feel good about themselves because they're like the uber principled, nationalists. And they want to prove it to you by telling you all their degrees and badges of not doing things they could have done. So they want to prove to you, look, I didn't do all these things. They should like flag, they shot like flags on the wall. Look at all the things I didn't do for the cause. I thought they have them on the wall to kind of make a point. Look, that's a degree of when I didn't do this, right? But sometimes it's a lot of ego gratification. Sometimes you have to bite the bullet. I do think it's an adulthood, childhood thing. The white nationalist movement is somewhat young. We are still young. So we still have youthful characteristics, right? So we go through birth, you know, and we're still like teenagers now. So we have to not go into a somewhat of a young adulthood as a white nationalist movement. That's why I reject these arguments that we haven't done anything. We were talking about this because you sent me a link. You could maybe, put it out something, but it's interesting because it's this argument that the white nationalist movement has been an utter and complete failure. And almost every white nationalist I meet tells me this all the time, like, oh, everything has been a failure. Everything is horrible. Nothing has ever been done. And I disagree. I think that they're losing perspective. In other words, we can't judge the white nationalist movement now because it hasn't happened. Understand what I mean? You can't just stop the clock and say, let's stop it right here and make it and just declare what's happening right now and just declare it a failure, because there's a process and everything that's organic, every creature has a process, has a life. It's almost like a Spenglerian view of the world, but you do have to go through birth and development, etc. The white nationalists in the United States have been going through that process, and even the people that criticize it are basically a product of it, so it's not really a failure. I mean, I can tell you, I've seen a process since the 90s till now. A lot more people in the movement, a lot better quality people in the movement. A lot of the ideas that used to be discussed before are not discussed anymore because we're over it, type of thing, right? So there has been a development, but we can't be short-sighted. We have to look forward. Again, we have to be strategic. We have to think long-term. We can't expect immediate gratification. If you're looking for immediate gratification, don't join a political struggle. Don't join a war. Don't participate in a struggle, because you're not going to get immediate gratification. We're not children. We have to be adults about it and understand that things take time. And we have to participate in it. And we have to relinquish the satisfaction of the results more than likely, right? A lot of us will have to. But we just do it because it's our duty to do it. That's our thing. We've discussed this before.
Yeah, and you mentioned, these are things that it's not that people don't know, but we do need to remind ourselves, requires sacrificing our personal comfort zone sometimes, and you've been addressing that really throughout the whole program so far, but, you know, this again goes back to that collective, the importance of seeing ourselves as a collective, because we can't just satisfy ourselves all the time. But we should find things that when we decide on what part we want to play, which should be something that we like, you know, that we enjoy. If we learn certain trades or abilities to do things, or, you know, you always need engineers. I mean, luckily for Adolf Hitler, Germans are really good engineers. But, you know, I don't know if we have any, you know, I don't know what the state of engineering is among white people these days.
Exactly.
But we sure do need them.
We have one in TeamSpeak, Bob. Okay. But yes, I agree. I mean, the issue is, yes, you can always do what you actually have a, you know, because I also believe that it's a genetic thing too, that you have a proclivity to a certain, you have certain skills, right? Not everybody's good at everything. But yes, you should actually focus on that. Look, in the white nationalist movement very recently, a couple of them particularly come to mind, which are educators. I mean, they have, I remember the story about this, I'm not going to mention names or anything, but in her school, she actually influenced to whether or not give Holocaust classes or not, and she was able to get it out, that type of thing, right? Now, that's a huge impact. I would say that's doing more than most of us have done, right? And when it comes to the impact that it has on at least 30 or more of 100 children, right? They're actually not going to be, you know, brainwashed for that type of propaganda. That's an example. See, this person is doing something that is practical, is using a skill that is actually very beneficial. Yes, within a system that is corrupt and horrible, etc. But it doesn't matter, because this person, because she is of our own mind, she will do it in our own particular ways and to the best of her ability, and that has an influence. Instead of shunning these type of things, we should actually embrace it. That's my point. And that's the reason I don't believe in this type of outing that a lot of people do to some of these people. For example, a teacher, a professor, people like this, if they choose to be of the quiet type, I let them go in that route because it does work in our advantage a lot. And Jews practice it because, for example, they change their names. And nobody knows they're doing what they're doing, and they're doing it on purpose, because a lot of times you want to have these silent types running around doing a lot of things. We would like the same thing. Instead of thinking of these lone wolf theories that are interesting, Metzger promotes one that's interesting. He's done it for years. The idea that it shouldn't be like a structured movement with leadership, but we white nationalists should be like on their own, creating havoc type of thing. But I apply this concept more to this, which is that we should have white nationals that are doing functional, effective, actual real-world things that we can utilize in the future, and they're functioning, and a lot of people don't even know they're there, right? I think that's actually a cooler concept. It's actually long-term and effective. And so I would basically extend the concept of the lone wolf, but I would take it to the level of actually of being educated and functional in that sense.
Well, but still, you do mean that only whites should be in the white nationalist movement. There shouldn't be any under any circumstances, as far as I'm concerned, should there be any non-whites accepted, and that includes Jews, of course.
No, yeah. The reason I mentioned Jews is because they do it very effectively amongst.
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah. Seeing how they do things, but I mean that we wouldn't allow any Jews in the white nationalist movement, even if they seem to be want to be white nationalists.
Yeah, of course, but that should be like the most obvious thing in the planet for a white nationalist. But yes, it's good to underscore, right? That of course not. But that's if they did, they would be doing what I'm describing. We're just trying to go down low into our movement and destroy it. But my point is that our enemies do these things, and they do it effectively. They don't want us to do it. They want to marginalize white nationalists purposefully, because they know that the more marginal they are, the better we are controlled and kept in a corner as misfits. That's my point. My point is that we have to get out of that. If we want to have real world activism, it should be, a lot of it should be working on ourselves, is my point, and then working on actually creating a network of efficient, qualified people who are themselves ardently white nationalists and want to fight for cause.
Well, is anybody doing that? I mean, there's different groups, but I'm one of those people that most of them turned me off for one reason or another. So, but I mean, who is actually, can you name some names? I mean, can you talk about some groups? I mean, what, are we just in a vacuum here where we're just talking in theory, or is somebody?
No. We are doing it. You and me right now are telling people that are listening, focus on these things. So, but that's the closest thing we're going to get, because most people that build movements, just like a product, they want consumers for that product. And the problem is that when you want consumers for your product, when you're starting out a company, you usually just want any consumer, right? Because you're starting out. So basically, a lot of white nationalist movement, they just accept anybody because they just want people, right? But a lot of people are not going to tell them uncomfortable things like, you know, get a job or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that's the type of thing you don't tell people that you want to be friendly with. In our case, I think it's more effective to have individual people actually making a decision to do these things. But if you're asking me about specific people that actually advocate this, mm-hmm. I would say I haven't seen one. This is the reason I wrote the article. If I had seen it, I would just say, check out this page, right? Because I haven't seen it, I decided to write it. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It means that I haven't seen it. But this is what we should, in other words, yes, it's the theory. My theory is that this is what we should be doing. Hopefully this theory becomes something practical can come out of the theory.
So you would say that you don't know of anybody who's leading, who's showing leadership that is, that you would point to and say that, you know, look at this person, because there isn't any. There isn't the kind of leadership that you would approve of right now?
Well, no, because we're not ready yet. That's the point. I think there will be. But the point is that right now we're not at that stage. We're still in the development stage. And now we're fighting with each other because we're not trying to develop into young adults. So hopefully we can get this process over with so we can actually become young adults and start getting actual quality people involved. And I believe everyone involved right now is quality. What I'm saying is that we have to train other people that could be part of the movement and actually give us something that we can that we can use, something effective we can use. We have a lot now, but we need a lot more, and we can't just become close and just shun everyone else.
Okay, so we have a long way to go, and we need some maturation, don't we? All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are coming up to our one-hour break, top of the hour break. We will have a five-minute musical break, and then I'll be back with Severus Nicholson. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour. Stay with us. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, as I said 5 minutes ago. And my guest tonight on the Heretics Hour is Severus Niffelsen. We are talking about moving toward a white nation and what that means and what how it needs to be thought about and what needs to be done and how well we're doing in as white nationalists. And so, Severus, welcome back. We kind of completed what you had written in your blog article, unless you want to say anything more about that.
No, I mean, I think people, I mean, if they're interested, they can read it. And probably they'll develop their own ideas of it. My basic point simply is that we should have a more practical view of these things instead of such a designer, you know, prefabricated conception of what a nation is. Nation is not a band, a rock band, or a small company. We're talking about a huge project, and therefore we should approach it with patience, and we should approach it with strategy, and we should be practical about it. That's what's the whole.
Would you mind talking just a little bit about the Northwest Front of that Harold Covington has been trying to sell for a long time now, because it is that, you know, he's sort of set up this place, or he's got some people moving there, and then they say this is what it's going to be, and you all should come, and we'll build this nation, and all the reasons why, and there's a lot of aspects to it that are completed. There's a flag and so on, and other things, of course, and rules and laws, and this might be the one where they have their constitution. I'm not sure, but you know, I don't want to put you on the spot, but you know, how do you see that kind of approach? Is this an example of what you'd say that doesn't work, that we shouldn't be doing?
Yes, I had them and also the Confederate States of America in mind, because the Confederate States of America actually even have a Department of citizenship, and you can get like your citizenship papers, and you can get like a certificate. They already have it set up, but it's all a website. But they already have this, right? Mm-hmm. But yes, the Northwest Republic is basically a prefab concept as well, because Covington, who was a very prolific writer, he's written a lot of novels, and all of it is about how the nation is going to be built. He advocates that he answers all the questions it could come up with, how would it work, etc. What kind of government structure it would have. They have a constitution. I would say even ratifying constitution, that's possible. So they do have a developed conception of this thing. But yes, that's basically my criticism, in the sense that you can't just do all that at the work. And he does call out people to actually say that you actually have to do it in the real world. The problem is that you already did most of the work for them. And this is a problem, because you cannot create an organic republic of writing five novels, and get people inspired by it, purchase your product, move into to the territory that you chose, you know, with a magic marker, and then somehow expect that the republic is going to be built in that way. And what happens to the people in New England? They have to run over that way when this country falls apart? I mean, what happens to those people? Are they going to be run by libertarian Tea Party types that they're going to allow non-whites to move in again? You know what I mean? Like, there's an issue with doing things pre-reality, because you're blocking yourself to a lot of good options, good things that could happen. You're not fluid enough, is my point. If things go down, and in New Hampshire or whatever, there's suddenly a couple of white nationalists that have convinced the local population they know what they're doing, why would I say, no, I'm going to stay here in Northwest Republic because I read these four great books and it seems it's going to happen, it's going to be awesome, instead of me taking a car and going over to the other side? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's no fluidity in these things. It can't be just all prefabricated for you and done for you and thought out for you. And, you know, I don't know. But that's a lot of other groups. I didn't mention them for the sake of politeness, but also for the sake of just discussing the issue. In other words, it's not a personal thing. I don't know the guy. It's an issue of the concept. I'm criticizing the concept. And there's a bunch of the Salutrians, the Confederates, the Northwest Republic. There's a bunch of them. It's not only a few. But all these guys share the same characteristics, and that's basically what I'm criticizing.
Yes. Yeah, so instead, we should be preparing individually, but with a collective spirit, kind of. you have to put a lot of faith in something that doesn't exist yet, is the way I see it. You put a lot of faith in it, and there are models to look at, such as Hitler's National Socialist Third Reich, and this is a good model to look at. But people get so excited about it, they get so upset with it, they hate it, they don't want anything to do with Nazis. You know what? It doesn't mean that we're going to be Nazi here in the United States, but it means that there's something to learn from that. Would you say? I mean, I don't understand this vicious anti-Nazi stuff that some of these people have, I've found, are coming up with now that talk about this white nation in America. And I'm surprised at it, truthfully. I don't know why it's so strong, why they're so afraid of it. It's like they're afraid that these Nazis wearing uniforms and swastikas are going to somehow take over the white nationalist movement and create this Nazi state. And they won't be able to stop it. I guess that must be why they're so
Go ahead. So, I mean, that's actually kind of the problem with our movement. I would say, like, the Northwest Front, they actually don't shun the imageries of National Socialism, at least conceptually. In his books, he actually talks about a statue of Hitler and everything. I mean,
he's different. He kind of likes them. I think that he likes National Socialism there, but I'm not sure exactly what his attitude is toward it. But then there's some others who are very anti.
I think that stems from something else. I think it stems from somewhat of a bourgeois uncomfortableness with the propaganda. In other words, the propaganda has been so effective that they believe that it's already done. In other words, the propaganda won, this war has been over, therefore we have to just shun it because they won the fight. In other words, they've convinced everybody that the Nazis are nuts, so therefore I don't want to be a Nazi. Sometimes it's actually that, and therefore it's not really, it's somewhat tactical. They really believe that, tactically speaking, we should shun swastikas and whatever symbols that the mainstream media have determined that they're evil. So we should shun it and create new things. I think other people legitimately have shunned it because they believe legitimately that they don't like it. In other words, they believe it is bad. In other words, they bought the propaganda. It is bad. So therefore, I don't want it. And these are the guys that talk about, like, libertarian type of states.
Okay. Well,
libertarian types of white national states in which everyone can do whatever they want, but at the same time, they have to be white. And they have to live collectively in a particular way. And it's somewhat funny if you think about it, because they're like the worst type of libertarians in the world, because they're not truly libertarian. And I did read the article of one of your guests regarding this issue. I don't know if you want me to discuss.
Yeah, something. Yeah, we can. I'm sure he wouldn't mind. Alex Linder, I just sent you that thing that was on Chechar's blog that he took from what Linder wrote. And I was a little surprised at that, too. I had not seen that before. And then there is Ward Kendall's Seven Foundations of a White Nationalist Nation, which I also sent you. You didn't have time to think any of this through too much. But we can, you know, we can just use these as criticisms of a more national socialist type approach and why they criticize it so much and how valuable their ideas are. Well, you're the guest tonight, so you spout off with what you think.
You can blame me.
No,
because these two examples are the perfect examples of the two types I said. See, I think one of them is a strategic one. The other one is a legitimately disagreeing one. In other words, Linder, I think, legitimately feels that authoritarian type nations are bad, right? I don't know. Just let me make that clarification. I'm just basing myself on that one thing I read. But the gist of it is that authoritarianism and this type of kind of centralized state is evil in itself, is a bad thing, and therefore we should shun it. Whereas Kendall is the last name of the other person?
Yes.
Whereas Kendall is basically making the argument that because the whole white nationalist movement has been deficient, then therefore we should shun everything from its past. In other words, we should get a divorce from the white nationalist movement from the past and create a new white nationalist movement that shuns and hates, actually, because he actually pretty aggressive about this. He actually believes that anything has to do with the Klan, anything has to do with skinheads, everything has to do with National Socialism must be shunned. And I'm talking about that. I'm talking about like websites, forms, symbols, even the mention of it should be shunned and rebuked and almost hated by the white nationalist movement. Mm-hmm. To get, I actually believe this is a strategic thing. When I did read it, I was not able to read all the way to the end because I had like a half an hour or something like that. But I did go to, I think, to like four of them, the 4 points plus the introduction. But basically, he's basically stemming from this idea that it's bad for us, so therefore we should shun it. I think it's wishful thinking. In other words, this is never. Because ironically, this guy is not like a dictator of the white nationalist movement, so he can't really control people and what they say and what they do. So even if he wishes for this to happen, it will not happen because human beings don't work that way, but things don't function in that type of perfect way. So you're always going to have a few guys that want to shave their heads and seek higher or whatever, right? I mean, the issue is whether or not we should shun them. In his case, I would argue he should probably try to convert them, not necessarily insult them and do the same thing that the mainstream media does. I think that's a wrong approach because I think that everyone has some role to play in a weird way, right? In a somewhat majestic way, things kind of function for a reason, right? So I think that the Linder type of argument, I disagree with it, but now we're talking about the theoretical thing that we're talking about. I mean, we can disagree, but I don't care. I mean, I disagree with it because I'm a militarist. You cannot have a militarist state without centralization because it won't function. I did want to mention what I said to you off air a few hours ago, which is that a lot of people confuse the state with the government with the type of government. And these are different concepts. You know, a lot of these guys that talk about, no, I don't believe in a centralized state, whatever, are usually confusing these terms because usually they don't like a type of state, so therefore they criticize that and they just call it the state. As an example, I like the Max Weber definition. It's a German philosopher. The Max Weber definition of the state, which is the monopoly of the use of force, right? It's a centralized political entity within a territory that has a monopoly of the use of force, right? Very simple type of a definition. Most sociologists use it, and it's a pretty general description of it. But if you notice, this doesn't really describe government, because government is the bureaucracy that runs the state, right? But the state is simply a territory with a monopoly of power, right? A centralized political entity with monopolized power. And this is not a bad thing, right? Because we're not anarchists. If we do believe that the state is bad, then we're with Marx, because Marx's view of the state is actually similar. Although it seems ironic, because almost everyone that calls themselves Marxist believes in centralized government. True Marxism, that the end game of Marxism is communism, and communism is stateless, because they believe in this idea of communes, and there's not really a government, there's not really a state either. There's no monopoly of police power. There's no monopoly.
Well, that's not how it turned out, though, is it?
Of course not, because...
I mean, it's interesting that what it's supposed to be is not what it ever was in practice.
He believed that this is like the classic Jewish thing, because he believed that would be the end result. But for you to get to that end result, this is the ironic thing, you have centralized power to force people to share to the point in which they get used to it. And then there has to be a second revolution that eradicates the state. Of course, what Bakunin said, which is an anarchist, they used to argue with Marx about this, was this is an impossibility. If you give more power to a government and to a bureaucracy, they will never relinquish it because they have power of it. So what you're the strategy that you're promoting is crazy. It will never happen. Communism will never arrive. It will always be state socialism, right? That Marxist socialism will never arrive at communism, because what you're creating is a monster. That's why anarchists didn't believe in going that route. They believe in destroying the state from the beginning. But I presume.
But now you say you're a militarist. Now that interests me. I hadn't heard you call yourself that before. Would you explain that a little bit for the listeners and for me, so that we know? I like the sound of it.
Yeah, I believe in the aesthetics, and I believe in the morality, and I believe in the functionality of military power and of a militarized state. And of course, our ancestors did historically. Historically, most of our nations, including the most primitive ones, right, even the smallest tribes, had basically a chief, a war chief, right, that ran the small little state, right, the small monopoly of force, which is basically his army. He would run things, but the culture of the tribe would be militarized. In other words, everything was focused around making spears, making knives, making swords, structure, hierarchy. These guys know what they're doing. These guys are under them. You follow the orders of this guy, that's the thing. The whole concept of structured, organized machine that basically defends its territory and will fight its enemies and will see this as a glorious, heroic thing to do is a militarized society.
And you have to have how can you survive in the world today if you don't have that? You know, the United States is a totally militarized, but we're told it's not. But you know, look at the size of our what we call our defense department, our military.
The military industrial complex?
yeah. That's really interesting.
Yeah, of course. I mean, any state worth of anything that we've had in our past have been militarized. An example, I give this example on a show I did with ProThink in Crystal Genia's show, was that if you notice, Bismarck, for example, he was not a military guy, but he would dress like an officer, right? Even though he was not, because a lot of our ancient cultures, all the aesthetics of militarism were considered to be the aesthetics of heroism, the aesthetics of power, the aesthetics of beauty. Our heroes would be on horses with swords, that type of thing, right? We didn't make statues of people lounging on couches, right? We made statues of men and horses with swords. Because militarism is the requirement of any society that has any capacity to defend itself and to become great, right? Now, militarism requires strong centralization in the sense that you at least require a government, which now we're talking about the bureaucracy, not the state. The state is already there. But you require a government that focuses militaristically on the values of martial heroism, a martial aesthetics. And of course, we like this. And that's the reason that a lot of us are attracted to, like, for example, National Socialist aesthetics, because they're militaristic aesthetics. The party is a militarized party. They wear military uniforms with military ranks, right?
What would the opposite of that? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get this in. What would the opposite of that be? I mean, people who are against militarism, what would they have to offer in exchange, you know, other than that, for a nation that would hold together and could survive?
Well, the thing is, they couldn't. The only thing they would offer would be a civilian type of society of consumers and basically like chronic relaxation snobs, right? In other words, America. But America was becoming, not what it was. In other words, the United States was highly militarized historically, and it still is. But the United States is doing a transition from a militarized society into a bourgeois kind of civilian type of society, in which civilians make every decision, civilians think everything, civilians decide everything, and the military is kind of relegated to basically to the job of fighting wars that the civilians decide they should be fought. And of course, in our case, it's actually worse than civilians because we're talking about foreign civilians. But the problem is that a functioning society without militarism cannot really function. In other words, you cannot have a society without a mechanism of war.
Yeah, I don't think so. Well, what about Harold Covington's Northwest Front? I like to define these things. Do you see anything like that there, or is that just they haven't even come to that? I mean, they haven't even reached that point to even talk about such things.
Well, they haven't, because in his novels, he does discuss this idea of almost like he's basically like copying a little bit of his experience of the Irish Republican Army type of thing. And he's basically transplanting the concept of the Irish Republican Army, in which you have civilian type of militias that basically fight the war. And of course, this is somewhat of a problem because purely civilian, I mean, you're going to have civilian type warfare at the beginning because you don't really have a built army, but eventually you're going to have a professional army, a professional military. His republic is not like that. His republic is somewhat of like a like an American type, somewhat libertarian type of nation. And usually those types don't like the military too much. It's not that they're pacifists. He's obviously not a pacifist.
Yeah.
He has a military presence in his novel. So I'm not even saying that he doesn't. I'm just saying that the aesthetic of militarism, Americans tend to shun it because they're afraid of it, especially in the modern days. Because in the old days, you know, having a general president would be like, it was the most awesome concept you can imagine, right? The first president was a general, right? So the original American Republic was militarized, I mean, conceptually speaking, right? It was all about military prowess, military victories, et cetera. Because that's the only way a nation gets built, right? Again, Washington didn't build it in his house. He built it out there in the field. But I'm not a fan of libertarian types because they seem to forget that without militarism and without a highly kind of overly excited militarist aesthetic and militarist philosophy and ideology, you can't survive, especially in the case that we're going to be attacked by everyone. So we're going to have to be high.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, you know, that doesn't seem to come up because there's no way we're not going to be attacked by everyone, just as you said. I mean, everyone.
Exactly. Everyone.
As soon as we do anything, we're attacked. As soon as we have a little club or have, you know, a little group or something, it's attacked all the way around.
The way I've envisioned this would be the following way. In other words, remember all these people I'm talking about that should be engineers and everything? Well, they would have to be militarized in every sense. In other words, you know, in the military, you have all these professions as well. The military is like its own nation state. The military, like the army, for example, they have doctors, lawyers, engineers, architects, whatever.
Yeah.
But they're all in uniform, right? Because they're all military personnel. And they everything they do of these skills, they're put to work for military objectives, right? The problem is the United States has been separating military from civilian as if they're separate. In our nation state, we wouldn't have the benefit of doing this, thankfully, at least at first, because we won't have that. We will have to fight constantly to survive for a long time. Every male... there's a white nationalist, and I would even say females in a lot of cases, would have to be ready to pick up a rifle and fight, and they would have to put their skills for military objectives, which is the same. Military and the nation state would be the same. So that's the way I view it. So because I'm a militarist, I can't agree with this primitive libertarianism that is somewhat utopian, this idea that without a state having a monopoly of force, somehow we can survive. We'll be invaded, destroyed from within, from without, from above, from below. You know what I mean? Like, we wouldn't be able to survive at all. And I always like saying the dynamics of power require structures of power. If you want to have enough power to survive, you're going to require the structures to sustain this power. And these structures of power are militarism. I mean, that's just how simple it is. So that's the reason I would have to advocate a centralized state. And this is the reason why National Socialist aesthetics are so attractive, because they're highly militarized. This is the reason that we like them, because they're very aggressively militaristic. And that's what we like the Roman Empire, very highly militaristic, right? That's why we like Spartans, highly militaristic, etc. I mean, the successful nations are militarized. This is just the truth. And when things happen, even the Athenians were highly militarized. A lot of people don't know that, but it's true. All these ancient societies that were large in Egypt, et cetera, Mesopotamia, they were all highly militarized. And the entire civilization was focused around military affairs, military heroism, martial values, loyalty, obedience, these characteristics that are classic of a military structure. These things are important. So to have these things, you have to have a high command structure, and you're going to have it centralized. You're going to have centralized power. You're not going to run an army like the anarchists, like it happened in Spain in the Civil War, which people have to take a vote every time they're going to take a hill. Hey, how many people want to kill those fascists? And people are taking votes, and the three don't agree, so they have to convince them. Next thing you know, the fascists are killing them all, right? I mean, why? Because they had one general telling the fascists what to do, and you had like 50 guys that all thought had an opinion, right? And power dynamics are not utopian, are realistic, and that's the reason I wouldn't agree with the Linder thing.
Yeah, the Linder thing, again, is it's the idea that you'd have a federal government that would protect the nation, I guess, and also ensure that it was stayed racially white. And then you'd have all the people forming whatever kind of groups they want to and under whatever beliefs they have. Now, how would that work when you have military needs? I just don't see. You'd have some, you know, it just doesn't even make any sense. I'm kind of surprised that he's even saying that, because he's an intelligent guy. I don't know why he's come up with something like that. I don't understand it. I mean, it doesn't, right off the bat, I say this is not workable.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that, though, is because he's thinking within non-military context, because he's not thinking, like, in other words, let's say that I make him a general, an army, and I tell him, okay, so you're going to run this thing. How are you going to run it? Are you going to let all your soldiers, your petty officers, that do whatever they want? Or are you going to have to tell them to do this, or are you going to put them in prison, right? Well, of course, in that position, he would probably agree with us and say, no, if it's a military operation, I'm going to have to run it this way. But he's not thinking in that.
Well, country. He doesn't want to be a general. No. He wouldn't want to be a general.
Well, but that's what I mean. I'm more as an exercise. The point is that most people, he's thinking as a civilian, and he's also thinking about in a pluralistic way, because that's what pluralism means. The true pluralism is the idea that the diverse groups can bargain for power within one nation state. That's what pluralism means. Most of these libertarian types believe in pluralism because we come from a pluralistic society. Aside from, we're pluralistic, we're multiracial, we're multicultural, I mean, that's a part. But pluralism in particular is very attractive to us because we do tend to think, who cares if the guy in his bedroom is, like a national socialist Satanist, right? I mean, that's none of my business, that type of thing, right? They're like live and let live type of thing. But the problem that we're not going to have that benefit. In other words, at least the first, and I'm saying at first, I'm saying like the first 100 years, we won't really have the luxury to be pluralistic at all. We cannot be pluralistic. We will have to be single-minded, highly structured, hierarchical, and militarized to be able to survive if we wish to survive. I mean, if we don't want to survive, we could just start a nation and just sit back and wait for it until they'll kill us all, right? But if we want to survive, we're going to have to be militarized. And if we want to be militarized, we can be pluralistic. We can't have multiple groups bargaining power inside your own nation state because it simply doesn't work. Because a state, again, by definition, is a monopoly of the use of force. And if you have the monopoly of the use of force, that means that others do not have it and they have to submit to that monopoly of force.
And there's all those people who don't like to submit. What would the leadership be in this militarized state? Do you see any benefit in one leader like the Führer, or do you see elected leaders or a group of leaders or what?
Well, you know, what's funny about this is because we're talking in theory, the truth is that a lot of these things will be decided at that time. In other words, as you know, in the moment that you have skirmishes and have people dying and getting shot, these things usually get structured fairly easily. And these structures are already done. In other words, I don't have to be like these prefab republic guys that I have to create a new structure. These things are already done. The military, all militaries have a similar, almost absolute system of structure in which you have higher general officers, which basically means a lot of people I see. Let me make this second quick. I see a lot of people, like for example, they dress up like in the SS uniforms, and they put themselves ranks like marshal or like and general. When these terms actually mean that you have more than 200,000 people under your command, right? It doesn't mean it's like, oh, I'm a general. No. These terms actually have an organizational meaning. So these things are usually organized by themselves. Again, what I think is going to happen is, in the moment there's chaos in the land, people are going to get together. If white nationalists are around, we can influence power. In other words, we can raise our hands and say, look, I know how to run this. I'm involved in this. I'm involved in this community. Let me participate of this. I assume leadership. The military situation is going to be done. In other words, the military situation is going to have to happen. And people are going to relegate that power. They're going to say, you know what? This guy knows what he's doing. I'll just follow orders because we're in an emergency. And human beings tend to do this naturally. We don't do it now because we're not in an emergency. We are, but people don't realize it. Mm-hmm. But an emergency, there's a fire, usually there's a guy stands up and says, run this way, people go that way like sheep, right? It's a normal thing to do. So we're going to have leadership, and hopefully it's going to be members of our own ideology, the Sunni's leadership, and this is going to be structured in a military way, and these nations are going to be organized like military states, right? And these have existed before, so there's not going to be something that's too great. We don't have to invent it. It already exists. The issue is, who are those men that are running it? My issue is that we, and I'm saying we, you know, being flexible, I mean we, people of our ideology, people that agree with us, would be in those positions, assume those positions, and then we just go along for the ride.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, too. These things, they form themselves, and people recognize the person who appears confident and say is willing to take some lead, is willing to lead, you know, in times of crisis, and they follow. You know, they go along with it. You know, Ward Kendall, here's something that he wrote in one of his later, in maybe the fifth or sixth or whatever, of his foundations for White Nationalist Republic. I'm hung up on this National Socialism being against it. He says, or consider the latter. First he was talking about communism, you know, why we didn't want that. And then he said, or consider the latter, National Socialism. Under its rule, the average white nationalist citizen would be subjected at all times to the red-hot breath of an omnipotent dictator under whose rule one's life would be at the mercy of. You see, there's people who are afraid of this kind of thing, who believe this. And I just find that kind of crazy. But
the thing is, I've studied since I was young, I always liked them. Because I come from a monarchist background, I was reading the arguments of anti-monarchists and then reading the arguments of, you know, anti-republicanism, etc. And one of my favorite issues is that those that live in republics actually believe that they don't have a boot in their neck, but they do. But it's usually a silent oligarchy type of people. They basically run the country. You don't see them. You cannot point the finger who it is, but they still run your life and tell you what to do. This fear of the omnipotent dictator thing, it's really comes from the Republican kind of an egalitarian camp, right? It was basically against kings, the idea that kings were these oppressive monsters, that even though we lived under kings and emperors for thousands of years, that this has been our system. But it's a modernist fear that we're somehow going to be controlled by this one guy, and if you don't like what he says, we're somehow going to be tortured and, you know, crucified upside down, whatever these guys come up with. But the truth is that you can never escape power, and you can never escape dominance, and you can never escape structure and hierarchy. And you can never escape the fact that there's always going to be people that have some say in what you do. This is just a reality. But again, this is, again, the issue of children and adults. When I was a kid, I shared this issue. In other words, I was afraid that if someone takes over and decides everyone has to, you know, I don't know, shave their heads, I'm going to have to shave my head because some of these things are usually somewhat fantastical views of authority. The truth is that if the same guy, you put him in the military, is he going to complain because the general told him to do something or the captain told him to do something? You just realize that if you're in the system, you have to kind of function through it. But when you're a kid, you don't like that because you want to do whatever you want. A lot of libertarians are in that camp. They want to do whatever the hell they want because they feel they deserve it, that they have a right to it. But they're only thinking of themselves, not thinking of the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is that he cannot escape that dynamic of power. It's the issue is whether or not you want to participate in that dynamic of power. In other words, you want to know who this guy is and you want to be in a country that functions or not. That's really the basic thing.
So, So get back to the idea of America and the United States or North America, I don't see that as becoming National Socialist. I don't know what you see. How would you see? Again, you see, of course, I know what I'm doing. I'm designing something here, and you don't like the idea of designing, but I'm I'm trying to get you to say what your design would be. So maybe that's a lost cause.
It's funny because I understand it. I understand. I can criticize what you said is interesting, which is whether or not this country has become a national socialist. I don't know what kind of nut job would actually believe this, because I mean, this doesn't make any sense. This country is basically as a civilian. It's becoming a civilian democracy of lazy welfare queens. That's how I would describe it. Basically, it's a nation of consumers and of fat consumers that all they want is to be entertained and to be satisfied, and they rather other people just make their decisions. And so, in other words, they don't mind living in a dictatorship, but the dictatorship that they want is a silent, obscure dictatorship that they don't see. In other words, they rather not see it. If they don't see it, they're happy, right? They're going to feel they're free, and they're free to consume. They're free to basically inject themselves with garbage and get drunk, etc. These are the type of liberties that they desire.
Yeah, and the invisible dictatorship is also, as you say, you can't point to it. You don't know exactly what it is, so it's not responsible, and nobody's responsible. And in the other, with the omnipotent dictator breathing down his red hot breath on you all the time, you know who it is, and that person is bad characterization, but that person is taking responsibility if they're doing it properly. If you're thinking in terms of the ideal national socialist state, that person is responsible, and you know who's responsible, and go ahead.
No, I'm saying a lot of these fears are fictitious fears. Because, for example, what you just described is a fictitious dictator. I mean, dictators really, not even Stalin was like that level of dictator. It's like you're basically describing like a deity. Basically, a lot of these fears come from like deity fear, almost like the Bakunin line that if God didn't exist, he would have to be abolished. If God really existed, he would have to be abolished. Which it basically expresses this fear of authority that is very extreme. It's kind of the similar thing. In other words, they really imagine this guy sitting in a huge mansion with like evil tentacles, and he dominates every single thing of your life. But the truth is that in every, even the biggest dictatorship, these people still require the assistance of countless members of a collective political group that actually functions and does things, right? And therefore, there's still a division of power. In other words, power is not always absolute in that top. And good example itself. I mean, you could even make the argument that that's one of the problems with how that war was run, right? That he didn't have absolute power. I'm not saying he would have done everything perfect, but what I'm saying is a lot of times generals say, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, that type of thing. So these guys didn't get hung right in the middle of the streets, right? I mean, usually dictatorships of the kind that he's describing is what he's really describing is almost like a theological fear of having a deity basically command and watching over you every time, almost like a 1984 type of fear. Even though reality doesn't really function that way, and natural structures tend to be hierarchical, and natural structures tend to have people that have more power than others. And a lot of these guys come from this school of thought in which egalitarianism is their worldview. So therefore, they do believe that somehow the less people with power, the more individual freedom you have, even though this is a fiction, because again, in natural states, you're always going to have a bigger fish. You're always going to have someone who has a bigger monopoly of force over you. And this guy with a monopoly of force over you can tell you to do things and not to do things. And we've lived right with our parents. If we're parents, we have a monopoly of power, etc. These things are the natural course of things, and I don't see any problem with it. Of course, we're going to want to influence power, and that's part of our political job, to actually influence power, to acquire, etc. These are things that are the natural things, but we can never escape authority. So I think it's a fool's errand.
Well, you're right. And now here's a thought that comes to me. It came before, but it's come back now. And I use Germany. I'm going to use Germany again. Say, if you talk about the type of national, so the type of Third Reich in Germany, the type of state it was, Germans, trust Germans. I mean, Germans are not afraid of being ruled over by other Germans. Some of them didn't want to be. There were some that were very politically left and so on. That it was really their politics. It wasn't that they didn't like something that was, you know, authoritarianism. They just did. They had different kind of politics. But when you translate that to white nationalism in the United States. And we have so many different points of view, and we don't really trust one another. I mean, we see one another, we start to see one another as enemies because we have different sects or groups, you know, that one likes, wants to go this way, one, they don't like the other's leaders or whatever. And so then you see that as you want freedom from all that. But I think that's partly because we don't have that national similarity, that national sameness that we can relate to one another from that perspective. And I think that's really important.
You know, what's funny about that, it's actually, I have a particular opinion about that because I think it's the opposite reason. Let me explain what I mean. The reason that we have all these divisions and people don't want to submit themselves to the authority of no white nationalist leader is because these leaders don't have actual power. That's the only reason you can have that luxury to say, oh, I'm not going to submit, because they don't have any power. So that's why I can make my own thing. I can make 20, 30, 100 different groups. But when reality actually happens, these groups tend to dissipate. An example would be the Cuban Revolution, where you have Fidel Castro in the mountains, and you had more than 50 communist, socialist, Marxist, Leninist, Marxist, Trotskyists. You have all types, right, of groups in Cuba that none of them wanted to submit to the authority of Fidel Castro. They would actually call them. He was up there like with 20 guys. They would go up there and say, screw you, I know what I'm doing. I'm in the city. I know what's happening. You don't know anything. You're in a mountain. That's everything. Once Castro started gaining real power, in other words, he actually had a monopoly of force. He had armies. He started taking over cities. Then suddenly these guys started, you know, they calling themselves Fidelistas and started joining the movement because real power has real effects. Whereas when you don't have power, you don't really have that much of an effect. And that's why you can have 50, 60 groups. At the end of the day, when Fidel Castro went into Havana, there were no 50 communist groups. I would say at the most would be two, right? Because at the end of the day, success is power. You have success, you get power. Once you get power, all these other guys will melt into you, right? They will adopt, they will accept it. They will merge into your movement. So the issue is which one wins. But because none of us have power, we're all going to have our own little factions until one of these guys wins. The same thing happened in Germany. And the same happens in all dynamics of power. If you study all power dynamics, they always function that way. You have 50, 100 groups. You have hundreds of tribes. Once a big guy comes in and starts, you know, killing a couple of, you know, starts spreading its wings and start growing, all these guys join up, and suddenly you only have one main power structure. So I think we have the luxury to complain. We have the luxury to fractionalize. But once we have a real world movement and we have a real world power, a monopoly, then things are going to change. You're going to see all these other groups agreeing with the other ones and being very friendly.
So we can't get away from that kind of power. You just can't live in this libertarian type environment unless you're going to have this hidden power behind the scenes running things. Isn't that what we're saying? That was what you're saying?
It's the greatest state that doesn't have a monopoly of power, doesn't have that much power. It's like a libertarian anarchist commune that your neighbor with actual power is going to come over and just take you over. And that's it. It's over.
Yeah, and so now back to Alex Linder. You know, and I like Alex Linder, but Alex Linder is talking about this state or this nation, this white nationalist nation, where you have a federal government that has I already said this. I shouldn't be repeating it. That has the power to, I guess, wage war on behalf of the people, and also is there to ensure the racial purity. But that's all. And then under that, everybody's free to organize the way they want into groups and even states and little municipalities or whatever, and to according to what they like. I mean, that is totally unworkable, wouldn't you say? Because how is this federal government going to have power to really do anything if you have everybody thinking that they can live however they want and have whatever kind of beliefs they want?
Yeah, it would have to grow. It would have to happen just like now, right? And this the Federalist Papers kind of previewed this reality, which is if you give some monopoly of power to a federal government, because they're the ones that have to do this, eventually they're going to have to acquire more and more power, and it's going to grow and grow and grow. Because the only effective way of running anything is to grow and centralize, grow and centralize, grow and centralize, that type of thing, right? If not, of course, the traditionalists would say, perfect, I don't want it to grow, and that's fine. But in our case, we're not going to necessarily, I'm not going to argue whether or not the United States was like that before. The point is, we're not going to have that much. We cannot depend on the federal government a white nationalist government. We're going to give them a monopoly of power. Look, you're going to have all the weapons. You're going to have all the capacity for war. You're going to have the capacity of government. But let us do whatever the hell we want in our own territories, because that doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't function, because these guys have to have the ability to go into your territory, recruit your children, put them a uniform on, give them a rifle, and say you're going to fight today, and mm-hmm. be able to organize. You can organize. I'm talking about like simple things like roads, the way to move military personnel around the country. You can't just have a community saying, you know what, I don't want tanks going through my territory. That doesn't work that way. So it comes to a point in which it would have to be centralized. But again, this is all fantasy, because at the end of the day, that type of state that he's describing would never come about like that, because it will. Every nation begins, when we're talking about like the birth of a nation, it always begins with war, revolution, civil war, however you want to call it. And these things are always military, and these things are always run by guys that actually have the guns and have monopoly of power. And guys that are speculating about federal or non-federal don't really have any say on it, unless they have a participation of that power. But of course, I've never seen a state that builds itself into a weaker self. In other words, I've never seen the story of a nation that starts after fighting a war with like powerful foes. And the only way you win through powerful foes is having a good military, good structure, good organization, good assets. And this is what we're talking about, different professionals, different people that know how to do different things. You win the war, and then you decide, I won the war, but now I want to make myself weaker. And I'm going to create communes, and people are going to run these communes. They're going to have their own chickens there, and people are going to do, you know. Mm-hmm. People don't work this way. People use.
Yeah, and another thing is that I had thought about the divisiveness amongst white people, say here in the U.S. and so on, and how we can always be fighting amongst ourselves. But then I realized that that's now. But if you ever did create a real white nation, then the children would be brought up in those beliefs, and they would, you know, you're always going to indoctrinate your children. It just depends on how they're going to be indoctrinated. So once you get the next generations being brought up all under the same belief system, then they wouldn't be that same kind of bickering that we have now, because we're used to thinking whatever we want to think not thinking collectively. There's this, of course, in America, there's this real fear and hatred of collective, the whole idea that even that word collective.
Yeah, it's because Americans have decided to hide in their houses and not come out, because everything they see outside is horrible. And it's legitimate. It is pretty horrible. People didn't see the world like that in the 50s and 40s. I've never read any story in the 40s and 50s and 30s of people that when the United States was attacked, even though if it was not attacked or whatever, because there's different conspiracy theories about this. But either way, the point is that Americans will go that same day and sign up to fight, right? There was a collective responsibility. The concept that everyone was together in this, and we have to join up and do whatever we have to do. And sometimes this type of energy was used for stupid things, but that's not the point. The point is that Americans did see the world this way. They don't see them anymore, because people are retreating into their homes, retreating into their neighborhoods, retreating into their fantasies, and they don't want to come out. But and this is the reason we can have all these things. But this is something I joke with people. Like I tell them, oh, what would you do? Like I would have a note in this telling me, what would you do if a CIA guy takes over the world, that takes over a country? And I say, well, then I'll move in. I mean, what are you talking about? I mean, the reality is that the one thing is speculation, the other thing is reality. If I'm in the middle of the Civil War, in the middle of the war, and there's a successful white nation being built, I'm not going to ask him, hey, can you send me some documentation so I can read up, you know, like I'm moving into a retirement community. Can you tell me your benefits? Can I read the kind of philosophy? No, I'm just going to win. And if I can participate in the definition of this place, I will have it. If not, my children will grow in within it, and they'll have their chance to influence power. And like you said, they will be indoctrinated into a particular view. But that can never happen if you are pluralism. Because your children will not be indoctrinated. This will be like a liberal type of white national republic, that you would send your children to a school, and then the guy in the school says, you know what, I have different options. I have a national socialism, but I also have a Odinism, but I also have, you know what I mean? Like that wouldn't mm-hmm. work. The state would have to define what is the philosophy of the state, what is the myth of the nation. Every nation has a myth. What is the myth of the nation? This myth is usually defined not by our theorizing, but defined on the ground. Washington was not a concept. He was part of the myth of the United States. The myth of the United States happened during the American Revolution, right? And then they invented a lot of the stuff that happened before. A lot of it was invention, right? Created after you had a war that was won, that you had men that actually participated in the winning of this war, and they reconstruct the myth, and they sell a myth to the population. The population grows up with this myth, and this myth becomes a reality. This is the process of creating a nation, and this is the reason that we can speculate about these things. We can talk about the things we would like, but at the end of the day, these things will be defined in that moment. So I'd rather prepare myself and prepare my children to make them leaders, to make them qualified, capable individuals. So when the moment occurs, these people can take these positions and influence power and influence the monopoly of power and actually create something that we would all like to live in, or at least would tolerate to live in comparison to the stuff that we live in now.
Yes. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. So, I mean, survival is always going to be an important part of it. I mean, there's no way to lay back and say, well, now we won, now we have what we wanted, now we'll all do what we feel like and enjoy ourselves. It's never that way. It can never be that way. We just, as I already said, I think this is kind of focusing my thinking here, but, you know, we just think that we have all this now because we don't know who's, we're not in charge. We don't have any say over who's really running things. So in one way, we have this freedom. In another way, we have this what you were just saying, this fear where everybody's hiding and hates everything, you know. So it takes some thinking through here, but people are not thinking through this enough, it doesn't seem to me.
Yeah, and the majority of us are basically, we live in a tyranny, but we live in the worst type of tyranny because we live in what I would call the invisible tyranny, which is the tyranny of entertainment and of consumption. It's a tyranny because we're basically forced into these patterns, and we're basically forced into our homes. We're basically hiding in caves, and we don't want to get out because we're basically angry. And we express this anger by basically trying to fantasize about what would be better, right? It's almost like we create our own fairy tale and we kind of dive into it. And this is legitimate psychologically. I understand that we want to kind of separate the ugliness and create something beautiful. But the problem is that we're doing this on ourselves. We're doing this in a fantasy world. And the problem is that this is a tyranny. So this fear of a so-called real-world militaristic tyranny is actually a fantasy. We are going to be part of this development, but we have to be realistic. And the realistic thing is that we are not prepared to take over a nation. We don't have leaders to take over a nation. We really don't. So this is what we should be focusing on, and not necessarily on prefabricating what we would think would be a great republic. Now is the time to actually get people that know what the hell they're doing instead of arguing about anything else. And like I said, again, this is the reason that sometimes we will always have arguments. Family, I see white nationalists, legitimate white nationalists, I see them as family. So we can have disagreements, we can argue, but at the end of the day, we're in the same boat. And we have to be honest. This is a theory, okay? Don't take it personal. It's a theory. It's not really happening. We're just talking, right? We have to have that view, or we would go crazy, right? We have to have a realistic, down to earth view of these things, and actually get to work on it.
Yeah, and we have to think in terms of us. We have to be able to see each other as us. We have to know who us is, and that's something that. That actually Tan Stoffel talks about a lot. Who is us? You know, that's so important to know that. And if somebody is a part of us, we shouldn't be afraid of them, and we shouldn't have a big problem with them, actually. But I'm interested in this. So if the leadership would have to be those, or should be those, or will be those, who are able to be military people, who are able to be militaristic, not those who not, and there are men who in no way, shape, or form can they take on such a role as that.
I agree. Yeah, that's the reason that a lot of our focus for those who are into recruiting, not to those of us that, because for example, I dedicate more energy to within the movement, but there's people dedicating energy to actually get people. It would be the highly militarized families of the Midwest, right? These Americans that do love the military, that do love militarism, they have this positive view of the armed forces, and would be addressing them in a way that they understand that they're fighting for their own people, but they should be fighting for their own people, that type of thing. But I agree, there should be people that at least have a concept, an understanding of military affairs. But we should leadership as will happen, and that's what happened to us. I choose to see that the people who are going to take leadership in this movement in the future, in the real world, are going to be my descendants. Because if I see it that way, I can have a humble,
honest. Okay, well, you're breaking up kind of all of a sudden. I don't know why. And we've only got a few more seconds. So thank you very much, Severus, for coming on today. It's been an interesting program, pretty challenging. It's been pretty challenging for me to keep up with it and try to follow everything. So if you want to just say goodbye or say any last words to the listeners.
Thank you for having me. It's always awesome to be in your show.
Okay, well, that's it. And so I say goodnight. And that's Nicholson's Nicholson at blogspot.com, and this is the Heritage Hour.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.